to Washington, D.C., and Bob Costantini.
Good morning, Bob.
Hey, good morning, Robert and John. President Biden delivered his farewell address to the nation, but it was it had its dark moments, to say the least, and it was, you know, kind of a lots of luck to you people in this country, and it really did. It came off that way for quite a bit, as he warned of this oligarchy that is starting to be part of the incoming Trump administration and wielding significant influence in the U.S. The president-elect's choices of cabinet members and agency heads are worth over $400 billion, and he has Elon Musk, the world's richest man, in his ear right now, and Jeff Bezos and Mark Zuckerberg, who are billionaires, also coming to the inauguration. They're trying to curry favor with the new Trump administration. And look, it perhaps isn't surprising that a lot of corporate America is trying to curry favor with the incoming Trump administration, because they're looking for lower corporate taxes, possibly, but also less regulation. And the president last night calling it a dangerous concentration of power in the hands of a very few ultra wealthy people. Quote, today an oligarchy is taking shape in America of extreme wealth, power, and influence that literally threatens our entire democracy, our basic rights and freedoms, and a fair shot for everyone to get ahead. So, you know, he did talk about the accomplishments of his administration, spoke a bit about the infrastructure bill especially, which will continue to blossom, if you want to look at it that way, or bear fruit long after he's gone, and talked about, you know, dropping the price of insulin and Medicare changes, et cetera, et cetera. So it was an interesting address, to say the least, the goodbye address from Joe Biden, even if today, by the way, he actually delivers an address as a farewell to the military as the commander-in-chief. That's part of his duties today, one of his the things on his schedule today, guys.
You know, when we talk about oligarchs, I know that's a 20th century, a 21st century term, but we have to remember that the founding fathers of the United States of America were all some of the wealthiest men, white men,
foundation
on the planet. You know. No, I mean, they were all extremely wealthy. They were what they called at that time the landed gentry.
Yeah,
plantation. Landed gentry.
Yeah.
Yes. And there were, if you weren't part of that, in some places you couldn't vote, of course, as part of that, white male society, the landed gentry. Biden sort of hinted to the famous Eisenhower farewell message about a military-industrial complex that was cropping up in the nation back in 1960. He called it a tech-industrial complex, Biden said, the tech-industrial complex, because so many of these wealthy people, from Elon Musk to Jeff Bezos and Mark Zuckerberg, have made their fortunes in the tech industry and websites and the things that they've done are from a society, a digital society, and how the internet has blossomed, and how that kind of that power now is in the hands of those people, and perhaps less so, I guess, maybe he thinks, than the Rockefellers of Standard Oil days, or the trusts that were busted by Roosevelt and other presidents eventually and broken up. These people do have obviously a significant amount of wealth, and he is surrounding himself with people who are extremely wealthy. And Biden, with his address, was basically saying, I was kind of a president that cared more about the middle class, but this next up president isn't going to be quite that way, more than likely isn't going to be quite that way, especially when these big tech people, big tech giant owners have his ear.
Now, I'm wondering, Republicans have always been thought of as being pro-business. Nothing wrong with that. We want business in this country to really be strong. But I wonder how that balance with Main Street businesses is going to fare under this oligarchy approach.
Yes, and look, the people who are the landed gentry or the robber barons or whatever tend to have the kind of money that gives you access to the halls of power, whether it be lobbying on Congress or being friends with a president of the United States. Look, presidents, when they go on vacation, don't stay in shacks, that kind of thing. When they go visit a place or something, and especially during vacations, of course, they tend to stay at the homes of people who are pretty wealthy places like the Hamptons or whatever, I don't know, or California and, Martha's Vineyard and the like. So that's, in a sense, nothing new. But Biden was specifically saying that he thinks the Trump administration is going to care a lot less about the middle class. Whether or not that comes down to something that that hurts small businesses, or that they don't care that much about small businesses, perhaps that was one of the things Biden was trying to warn against last night. It took on a dark tone for quite a while there, it seems. He thanked his family, thanked the nation, of course, at the end, and what a privilege it was to be president. But boy, did he delivered a message of significant warning, stuff that basically that he had said during the campaign about how Donald Trump and the people around him may pose a threat to democracy. We heard a lot of that during the campaign, and yet Donald Trump was elected anyway by the people, by and large. I guess people were upset with inflation, as we know, and the border situation. But what will he do? This is what Joe Biden was really hinting at, is what will he do to help you, average Mr. and Mrs. America?
What about his cabinet? Now, it appears that, at least it does from our perspective here, and I want to get your perspective on this. Does it look like he's got clear sailing to get everybody through?
Well, we talked about Pete Hegseth yesterday from his hearing a couple of days ago, who probably is going to get through. And yesterday we had Marco Rubio, who is going to sail right through before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. The interesting hearing in the spotlight yesterday was Pam Bondi, who is the president-elect's choice for attorney general. And, again, this also kind of hints at what part of Biden's message was last night. The Democrats on the Judiciary Committee pressed Bondi on how much she might listen or take to heart things that President Trump might tell her in terms of, prosecuting his perceived enemies or people who've wronged him down the line. Now, in Trump's first term, he often on Twitter, no less, very publicly, urged his attorneys general to prosecute his perceived enemies. They, both Jeff Sessions and Bill Barr, pushed back on that idea. And as I say, it only seems his desires for retribution only seems to have grown since what happened to him, since not winning re-election in 2020 and still claiming that election was stolen from him and the January 6th committee. So there is this real zeal that he has to somehow get back at his enemies. And whether Pam Bondi is going to bend to all that is a big question mark. She basically said the right things that you would say. One of her quotes is, "It would not be appropriate for a prosecutor to start with a name and look for a crime." And, you know, again, this is what you would expect her to be saying if she's going to win approval in the Senate. She can't go out there and say, yeah, I really can't wait to put that whole January 6th committee behind bars or anything like that, as if that really could be possible. You know, there will be some effort made. I don't know. But, you know, as she did point out, it would not be appropriate for a prosecutor to start with a name and then look for a crime. And a lot of legal analysts say that's what she would be doing if she decides to go after, you know, the likes of Liz Cheney or Adam Schiff, et cetera.
Well, speaking of the transition here, of course, the question is who's going to get the credit for the ceasefire in Gaza. You can call it a ceasefire, and we're going to get a ceasefire, and maybe we'll get the hostages back alive and dead, and everybody will be satisfied with that. But Bob, from your perspective, what are the possibilities of actually a lasting peace there at Gaza?
Well, let's hope. And you know, this ceasefire agreement that both Biden and Trump have been taking credit for, you know, Trump's special envoy did do some work on this in line with what the Biden administration has been trying for months to, you know, bring a ceasefire. And at the same time, of course, win Hamas's release of the remaining hostages, those who are alive, numbering perhaps 100 or fewer, and some who may have died in some way, that their bodies would be returned to Israel. This is in trouble already, in a sense. There were these big announcements, and again, as I say, Biden and Trump took credit for it. But the latest news I've heard is that the Israeli cabinet, with the advice of Netanyahu, the prime minister there, has put off a vote on the deal, claiming that Hamas is still bringing up some issues as part of this agreement. And it would allow for about a third of the hostages to be released almost immediately and consecutive other thirds as this agreement lasts, if it holds. And let's hope. That's all we can do, really, is that this will be a firm agreement. We know Netanyahu likes Donald Trump. Donald Trump was willing to let Netanyahu pretty much do whatever he wanted when Trump was president, and moved, of course, the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. So, you know, if this doesn't hold by the time that Donald Trump takes the oath of office, then, you know, there'll be pressure put on Netanyahu some more to agree to this, and just to make sure, and there'll be people trying to make sure that Hamas lives up to its end of the agreement. Now, your question was, John, whether or not this will bring some kind of lasting peace to the area. There are a lot of people who believe that because of the death toll in Gaza, the significant death toll, that what has occurred, and, you know, we have to remember, of course, it was Hamas that attacked Israel, killed over 1,200 people inside Israel, most Israeli citizens, but others, other nationalities, including some Americans, who were killed in that attack, in that incursion into Israel by Hamas. We have to remember that's how it started, but Israel's conduct of the war and the way Gaza has suffered, you have to wonder if it hasn't created, and this is something that I think Tony Blinken brought up the other day, if it hasn't created really as many, you know, potential Hamas terrorists or Hamas members or whatever as have been eliminated with the Israeli offensive inside Gaza.
Bob, as always, we appreciate your great reporting, and thank you for drilling down for us this morning.
All righty, guys.